Now, it's been a fairly busy week on all things pandemic, not least with the news about AstraZeneca, the news about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, the news that we were getting more Pfizer vaccines, the news that now some people will be exempt from mandatory hotel quarantine, the EU kicking up a fuss around who is and isn't subject to mandatory hotel quarantine, and a whole host of other things. Possibly one of the busiest men in the country, Stephen Donnelly, the Minister for Health, is with me in studio. Minister, good afternoon and thank you very much for coming in. There's all those things that I just mentioned, and yet the first thing that I have to talk to you about is the proposal that you floated in one of yesterday's newspapers about examining whether those who are aged under 30 should have access to a COVID-19 vaccine before those who are aged between 30 and 50. What is the logic behind it, and is it happening, or where does this proposal actually stand?
Good morning, Gavin, and it's a pleasure to be here with you. The short answer is no. So NIAC, in their original prioritisation, identified younger cohorts as cohorts who had higher prevalence of the disease. And what they said was, if the data on transmission gets to a point where vaccinations show a very, very significant decrease in transmission, that this group should be prioritised. So certainly it wasn't floated, and there is no plan in place. I simply asked the Deputy CMO his view, given that it was in NIAC, given that we're always doing everything we can to make the programme as effective as possible. And I can tell you that the Deputy CMO came back. I basically said, is the transmission data at a point? And he said, no, it's not. So it was one of many questions that we regularly ask about the program.
But you say it was something that NIAC raised, or NIAC put in their original sequencing, and they did in that original document back last November. But it's only less than 3 weeks since you brought a revised program to Cabinet overhauling the total vaccine sequence so that people would be vaccinated not on the basis of the risk of exposure or the risk of transmission, but solely on the basis of how seriously ill they might get. Is this not completely throwing that out the window again?
So nothing is being thrown out the window. Remember, there is no plan to do this, and there was no proposal to do this. All I was doing was checking in with the Deputy CMO to say, where are we at with the transmission data? He said it isn't there, and that's it. That's really all there is to it.
But even you asking NIAC to investigate it, is that not a material change on what you brought to Cabinet 19 days ago?
No, not at all. Myself and Dr. Glynn are constantly in NIAC, and the task force and NPHET, we're constantly probing all aspects of this. We're constantly asking questions around the vaccination programme, around sequencing, around rollout, around vaccination centres versus GPs, around public health measures. Like, part of our job is to constantly probe and question and try and find ways to improve things. But on this specific issue, there was no plan. There is no forecast, and nothing was being floated. I was simply asked a direct question: is this something you had looked into? And I said, yeah, it is. I'd look for an update, and the update is no, this is not something that would be supported by the data.
Would it not be a material revision of what you've done, given all the political capital that was spent in the last 19 days facing down teachers' unions who thought they originally were going to be higher in the queue than they were? And Martin Marjoram was on News Talk Breakfast this morning reasserting those concerns, that then not only to treat everyone by age, but then also to go back on that and to treat some ages who are less likely to get more sick and to prioritise them above others? I mean, it doesn't, for a lot of people, sensible as it may be on a policy perspective, just politically, it just seems daft.
I think people would expect me as Minister for Health and all of those working on the vaccine programme to constantly be probing, constantly be asking questions. That's really all this was.
So it was just a question that you were asked by a reporter. You said, I'd asked it, and is it happening?
That's it.
Are they even considering it?
No, the Deputy Chief Medical Officer has already come back and said, no, the data doesn't support it. So this was literally one of many questions we ask on an ongoing basis. I happened to have been asked it by a reporter, and I said, yeah, it was something that had been asked, but that's it.
When did he get back to you to say that it wasn't going to be stood over?
Probably Thursday or Friday.
Okay, yeah. So by the time it was reported, it had already been dismissed by NIAC and by the Deputy CMO?
Certainly by the Deputy CMO, he'd come back to me, maybe on the same day, I don't know, certainly Thursday or Friday.
Okay. On mandatory hotel quarantine, which has been a big issue on your desk this week, I don't think anyone in government has ever explained why there appear to be certain criteria that apply to non-EU countries that don't apply to others from within the EU. So why is it that European countries are only added on the basis of variants of concern, while non-EU countries can be added simply on the basis of how much COVID they have?
Really, it's in recognition of the fact that we are in the EU. There are obviously very serious commitments in terms of freedom of travel. And so we were looking at the EU countries and some of the Western countries and saying, well, specifically for these, we're going to apply the bar of the variant of concern. And then for the rest of the world, we're going to use three bars. So variant of concern, cases over 14-day of 500, and then cases over 2.5 times our current rate.
Why the difference, though, between the two? Because if you have a country right now like Cyprus, for example, which I think is one of the highest incidence rates in the world, someone coming from Cyprus is not subject to mandatory hotel quarantine, but someone coming from a non-EU jurisdiction that has far less COVID would be expected to spend 12 days in a hotel. Why the difference?
In recognition of the fact that the European Union it is different. So what we have is we have, by quite a long way now, the strongest measures in place against importation of variant. We are members of the EU, and so we're cognizant of that. Nonetheless, even though we do have the various bars for the EU and the rest of the world, we do have the strongest measures in place. And I think critically, what we're seeing is they're working.
Well, the measures may be too strong, though, because the European Commission said through a spokesperson on Friday that they thought that the goal of protecting public health and trying to extract more variants of concern could be achieved in less restrictive ways. Well, and they wrote to you to point that out.
They did, and they are more than welcome to their opinion. But our job is to keep people in Ireland safe, particularly safe from the importation of variants. So, of course, we have an ongoing and very positive relationship with the European Commission. But let's make no mistake, our primary objective and my primary focus as Minister for Health is keeping people in Ireland safe. We've identified the importation of variants as a significant risk to the country. So what we've done is we've moved first and we've moved furthest in Europe. So remember, we have pre-flight PCR, genome sequencing, home quarantine, hotel quarantine. The important thing is, Gavin, that it's working. If anyone listening this morning were to look at what's happening in Canada right now, they're dealing with a very, very significant surge, and they're dealing with a surge in variants. Look at what's happening in France. Look at what's happening in various countries around the world. What we have put in place is a system that, first of all, radically reduces the number of incoming travellers from those countries. And then secondly, if somebody does need to come in, and of course some people do need to come in, that there's a very strong biosecurity measure in place. And it's fair to say it is working.
Well, another country that has a problematic issue at the moment, and we were talking to Gabriel Scally about this in the first hour, is the southeast of England, which has a new outbreak of the so-called Indian variant, this kind of double mutation. And they appear to be seriously concerned that perhaps it might undermine the efficacy of vaccines. Is there any prospect of us adding Britain to that list?
I was talking to the deputy CMO actually just this morning on the variant that was first identified in India. It is a very concerning one, and he and his team are looking at that in the coming days.
So there may be a recommendation coming from him as to, again, impeding travel from Britain.
Well, I don't want to preempt anything particularly in regard to Britain, but certainly they are constantly looking at all of the variants. And the Indian variant is one that they are looking at.
You signed off this week on an exemption for people who are fully vaccinated, or at least if they've got the vaccines that are already administered in Ireland. So, for example, if someone's got Sinovac, they don't fall in. But if someone has received Pfizer or Johnson & Johnson, they might be exempt. The WHO, and I know NEFA takes a slightly different view on this, but the WHO says the jury is still out about whether somebody who is fully vaccinated can still transmit the virus, let alone any of the new variants. Are you absolutely confident in the scientific soundness of allowing an exemption for those who have vaccines?
I'm absolutely confident in the advice that I've got. So this has been looked at. There was a government decision about 2 weeks ago to review the case for those being vaccinated being exempt. As you say, it's only for vaccines that have been recognised by the European Medicines Agency. And then there's different timelines for after your second dose. The view after that review from our public health officials was that it did warrant an exemption. Remember, though, it's an exemption from hotel quarantine, but you still have to go into home quarantine as well. So there is still a very robust measure in place.
But there's obviously a recognition that home quarantine isn't nearly as robust and does pose the prospect of a virus leaking out, because if it was perfectly robust, you wouldn't have hotels in the first place.
I think that's right. And what we're always trying to do is to find the right balance between having very, very strong measures in place and recognising that people do still need to come in and out of this country.
But if they can still come in and out of the country based on, you know, making a humanitarian appeal, I don't know whether it's to yourself or to the Minister for Foreign Affairs, but there is one way of doing it. But if the jury is still out on whether a vaccinated person can bring and spread a variant of concern into this country, why take the risk?
Well, the jury isn't out from our own public health team. So obviously I take my advice from NEFET, I take my advice from the CMO here, and they are of the view that the balance is sufficient and the data on transmission is sufficient such that an exemption is warranted.
Okay. Earlier this week, obviously, we got very good news from Pfizer. We now know that we're going to get an extra 545,000 doses, I think, this quarter above what we had already expected to have. It does raise the tantalising prospect that if you were to space out the doses and to ration them across the population more broadly, that you could potentially vastly exceed your target of having 80% of adults receiving one dose by the end of June. How seriously is that being taken, and when might we get a decision on that?
It's being taken very seriously. So what we're looking at is extending the case for extending from the 4-week interval to maybe an 8-week interval or indeed a 12-week interval. We're looking at the impact that would have on the number of people who get their first dose. We're also looking at the clinical situation as well. Is there any clinical advice backing it up or suggesting that there might be an interval that is too long, for example? I expect a recommendation this coming week. And we'll see where that goes. It's an interesting one, Gavin, because the reason it has come about is the data from the field on the effectiveness of these vaccines is just absolutely astonishing, including on the first dose. So the recommendation from the manufacturer has been and remains that there should be a 4-week interval between the doses. But what we're seeing and what other countries are seeing is an extraordinary reduction in cases, reduction in hospitalizations just for one dose, which poses this question.
Is there any prospect of an extension applying to those who have already got their first dose or those who might get it in the coming days, or would it only apply to people a little bit further down the queue in lower cohorts?
I don't want to preempt anything on that. I want to wait to see what recommendation comes to me in the coming days on that.
I should have asked you, by the way, just on brief mention of the Indian variant of concern, do we know if there's any cases of that in Ireland at this point?
We're not aware of any at the moment.
Okay. On the broader vaccination programme, obviously this week's news again was quite good from Pfizer, particularly as it came in the aftermath of somewhat disappointing news about the use of the AstraZeneca vaccine and then the suspension of Johnson & Johnson deliveries. Are you absolutely confident that we can actually reach the targets of 80% of all adults by the end of the second quarter? Because, you know, you talk about the HSE getting 95% of all doses out in the week they come in. As of the 31st of March, which was the end of the first quarter, 18 days ago, we'd received 1.17 million vaccines into this country. Only last Friday did we administer 1.17 million vaccines. There's almost 18 days worth of vaccine that we haven't given out. Now, I know there was the AstraZeneca suspension. There's little bits of buffer that you have to keep up. But it seems as if that we're not being as efficient as we could be in getting out the doses that we have in hand.
We are being efficient. So there are two issues that you've spoken about them both. One is, there's a certain amount that we have to retain as second doses. So Moderna, for example, have said, whenever you administer the first dose, you must keep the second dose in the fridge, ready to go. So obviously that leads to a certain amount of buffer, and we have to have a buffer for the other vaccines as well. And then, as you say, last week, there's no getting around it. The program took a knock. It was a rocky week. We started with the recommendation on NIAC, and we were busily reprofiling that. And then we got the news that Johnson & Johnson were pausing on their deliveries of the vaccines to the EU. And we're waiting to see what the EMA says this coming Thursday. And then probably a few hours after that, then we got some very good news, as you say, on Pfizer. So this week, the amount administered, for reasons I think everyone would understand, has been lower. However, at a very useful meeting with the task force and the HSE on Friday, and what we're looking to do is make up the shortfall from this week in the coming week. So I think it is fair to say that the vaccines have been and continue to be administered very, very efficiently in terms of when they come into the country versus when they are administered into people's arms.
Okay, so the fact that there's a little bit of a gap between receiving 1.17 and actually administering 1.17, you think that's totally within the bounds of normality and that there's no issue with the long-term programme?
I do, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Mail on Sunday today tells us, we learned a little bit of this from the Taoiseach earlier this week, that when the next decisions come before Cabinet for relaxing restrictions this coming May, that there may be a long-term timetable for what happens in June and July as well. And indeed, the Mail on Sunday today even outlines hypothetical dates for when inter-county travel may be allowed, for when hairdressers can reopen, when other non-essential retail can return to click and collect. How advanced are those plans, or are we likely to receive the next time that the Cabinet considers all of this a full timetable for the reopening for summer?
We'll certainly get more detail. It may not be possible to give a full timetable right through June, July, August, September, because we have to see the progress on a month-by-month basis, and we have to see the advice from NPHET. What I can say is that when the COVID committee and the Cabinet sat down just a few weeks ago to talk about what would happen in April and then what could be considered in May, we are now in a significantly better place than we were then and that was forecast then. Mm. So the best case scenario we had 4 weeks ago when we were looking at these measures was an R number of 1.2. And it looked like we might be going up to about 1,000 cases a day before it began to come back down again. And two things happened after that. One is that the public health team And the government and clinicians and people all over the country came back out with this message that said, look, we're doing well. We've made great progress. We need to stick to the measures. Mm. And the second thing is people did that. And I cannot overemphasize the thanks and the credit that goes to every household in this country. We're dealing with this B.1.1.7 variant. And in spite of everything we're dealing with, because people backed the public health measures, we've actually still got the R number below zero. And I think the people of Ireland deserve huge credit for
that. Below one, I presume you meant. Whatever happens to data, not dates, though? Because it seemed as if when the Taoiseach was saying, right, well, we'll outline what people will be able to perhaps expect in June or July, and whichever one of your cabinet colleagues is talking to the Mail on Sunday today is already outlining specific dates. I mean, whatever happened to the public premise that you took only 3 weeks ago?
In terms of?
Data, not dates. One of your cabinet colleagues is giving dates today to the Mail on Sunday.
Yeah, look, I can't speak for whoever that is. All I can say is that as cabinet, we'll take the advice from NPHET. We'll look at society and economy in the round, and we'll provide as much granularity as we can. But I think people really do understand, given the year that we have been through, there's so much uncertainty. We're guarding against these variants coming in. We're making huge progress in keeping the curve flat and actually bending it slightly down. And the vaccine program, as you say, is on target, notwithstanding a very rocky week. So the more that we can continue on those three things, suppressing the variants, accelerating the vaccine program, and suppressing the cases here, the more opportunities there are and the more granular we can be. But I do think, Gavin, at this stage, people understand there's so much uncertainty in fighting COVID-19 that we need to give as much granularity as we can, but the things do change and can change very quickly.
So might there be dates dependent on hitting certain targets along the way? You might give people a calendar pending on achievements.
You know, the exact approach to this hasn't been agreed yet.
Can I ask you one very brief question before you go? There's a piece on the front page of today's Sunday Times where Ireland's four Catholic archbishops say that they're taking legal action after you, and in their words, clandestinely outlawed public mass and other religious services in church this week. I can sort of hear you giggling, so I presume you don't accept the premise of this. But you did sign off on regulations this last Monday, which said that a minister of religion or a priest or any equivalent of can only go to a church to lead worship or services remotely through the use of information and ICT, or to minister for the sick. In other words, that it would be a criminal offence. It would be a breach of these regulations for a priest to go to a mass, to go to a church to celebrate a mass.
So first of all, I don't think giggling is something that I've ever been accused of. Okay. And I'm certainly
apologies
not.
If I misheard you. I'm
certainly not. I take this very seriously. And I know that there are people all over Ireland who've been through a huge amount, for whom going to religious service and not just doing it online is incredibly important. And I would be very happy to meet the four archbishops. I believe they're looking for a meeting. We have to take this very seriously. Now, I disagree with their view. There is no clandestine thing going on here. There is very simply a very important public health measure, which has nothing to do specifically with targeting religious service, which is incredibly important for so many people. It's to do with ensuring that we protect the progress we've made by not having large indoor gatherings. But you'll know, Gavin, from the government decision a few weeks ago that from May, specifically religious services on a staggered basis are being looked at. So I'm very aware, and government is very aware, that the measures have been in place have come at a very high price for people who want to celebrate their religion, who want to go to mass, who want to go to service. We take it very, very seriously. And as soon as the public health advice says it is safe to do so, rest assured, we will be opening that back up.
Okay, we'll wait to see exactly what comes out of any meeting you might have with the archbishops. In the meantime, we'll let you go. Thank you very much for your time this lunchtime. Minister for Health and Fianna Fáil TD for Wicklow, Stephen Donnelly, TD.